Should greyhound racing be banned in Florida? My attorneys for the state say yes. Good Monday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross and hope you had a great weekend. We are back on the air and back in Studio 5, always live at 9 each weekday morning. You can also subscribe to our podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. And just ahead, a closer look at the controversy over a constitutional amendment that would ban dog racing here in Florida, one of the only states still doing it. Where do you stand on this? Give us a call. Let us know what you think. 549-2937. Then later, local author and news producer Nikisha Williams on her new novel, The Appeal of Ebony Jones. Plus, Culpepper stops by a little later on as the Jaguars get ready for their first preseason game of the year on Thursday. All of that ahead this morning. But first this hour, it's a practice that has been outlawed in most other states in the union. But dog racing, as controversial as it is still legal here in Florida. Last week, a circuit judge blocked a proposed constitutional amendment that would ban greyhound racing in this state. Attorneys for the state moved quickly to appeal that ruling and keep that amendment on the fall ballot for voters to decide. Now, Amendment 13, that's its number, would prohibit paramutual operations from racing greyhounds or any other dogs for wagering. This amendment on the November ballot, if it makes it, would phase out commercial dog racing in connection with placing bets by the year 2020 here in Florida. Florida, of course, has 11 dog racing tracks, including one in our area in Orange Park. So here's the question. Will voters get the chance to have their say on whether we should phase out dog racing in the state? Well, A.G. Gencarski of Florida Politics has been following this story, and he joins us now with an update. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
Always good to see you. Already getting calls. Where do you stand on this push to ban greyhound racing in Florida? Call us up, 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online. Send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. Or let us know your thoughts on our Facebook page. Okay, so attorneys for the state moved pretty quickly last week to appeal the circuit judge's ruling. Leon County Circuit Judge Karen Gevers ruled that the proposed dog racing ban, Amendment 13, should not go on the ballot because she said it would be misleading. And she called the push to get this amendment on the ballot trickeration.
Right.
And that's all anyone's been talking about, this word. First of all, I didn't know that was a word.
It's a Cab Calloway song.
Oh, there you go. It's yeah. All right. She called it trickeration. So let's begin there. Why did this judge, Judge Gevers, say, no, I'm blocking this move to get Amendment 13 on the ballot?
Well, the, you know, per the case, the ballot summary and title were misleading. They made it seem like dog racing would be banned writ large. They could still bet on a dog race, a simulcast from elsewhere. That was something that was elided in the amendment language. And also, you know, the fact that it would expand gambling, as this amendment is conceived, if these tracks phase out dog racing, they could still have horse racing or highlight or whatever. A lot of this is just a workaround to the state's gambling issues. I mean, we give the Seminole tribe a lot of leeway in terms of casino gambling. And, you know, you still have a very powerful track industry and gambling industry otherwise. So, you know, they want their cut too. So, I mean, you know, the dog track races have become less popular over time. In the 80s was kind of peak dog racing. The last decade, they've lost like 80%, 90% of their market share. And, you know, so this is basically a dying model, but they want to keep the tracks going. They're very politically connected. We have politically connected dog track here, for example. So, you know,
best bet.
Yes, exactly. And, you know, the bet is basically that if they ban this dog racing, if this amendment succeeds, like Pam Bondi, our attorney general, wants, then, you know, there will be something else for them to make up for the revenue and make it seem like you aren't just running gambling parlors. You have gambling alongside of, you know, live sports action.
It's 549-2937. Let us know how you would vote if this amendment makes it to the fall ballot to ban dog racing in Florida. Now, we have 11 dog racing tracks. As I said, as you pointed out, one is down in Orange Park, the best bet. This controversy has steadily grown over the years, though, because investigative reports, particularly one by the Tampa Bay Times, found that a dog dies on a Florida racetrack every few days.
Yeah.
From injury, from heat stroke. Sometimes there have been reports of dogs being given drugs to race faster. So animal welfare groups are up in arms about this, saying it's a barbaric practice. A majority of states have banned it. Florida, I guess, is an outlier in this. And now we see the state moving to appeal this judge's ruling. Pam Bondi is a member of the Florida cabinet that would like to see this banned as well.
Right.
One of the rare times you see liberals in Florida lining up behind Pam Bondi on this issue of loving dogs, loving animals, right?
Yeah, I think that's one of the seven signs. But, you know, Bondi was on the Constitutional Revision Commission also. And, you know, she had a very evocative quote saying that these dogs, they leave the track, if they leave at all, skin and bones. They basically are run to death. They're scared of their own shadows because of the training methods. You mentioned the drugs being used, cocaine, steroids, they're used for greyhounds. And, you know, we have to wonder why, in terms of, you know, being participants in civil society, why this is happening, you know, to these dogs. Obviously, the greyhound industry, its lobby has its own take saying that they're treated humanely and so on. And, you know, that's part of it. But, you know, you have the attorney general basically saying the animal rights people. I believe Matt Gaetz is also on the side of the amendment. It's something that, you know, it seems like for many people in Florida, you know, this idea has come and gone, this idea of dog racing. I mean, we've seen objectionable displays before in terms of popular entertainment, and they get phased out. There was dwarf tossing a few decades back, and dwarf tossing actually had to be banned by the legislature. That was a popular thing in bars where, you know, little people were thrown
for money. Were tossed around,
yes.
Yeah.
And, you know, so it's just basically something where as we evolve as a society, we realize that some things that we might have taken for granted are actually barbaric. And that seems to be where we're at with dog racing right now.
It was instructive to know, too, this amendment was one of only eight that made its way through this Byzantine process of the State Constitution Revision Commission. They meet every 20 years and they are the gatekeeper to get these amendments through for proposed constitutional changes. And out of all the ideas considered by this commission, and it was a controversial process, this was one of less than 10 that got approved overwhelmingly by this commission.
Yeah, and you know that speaks to the unique coalition that, you know, is on the CRC. A lot of Rick Scott appointees, a lot of appointees by House Speaker at the time, Richard Corcoran, Senate President had appointees and so on. So, you know, it was a right-leaning thing, but wasn't exclusively right. Hank Cox, local trial lawyer, he was on the commission. So, you know, it's something that happens every 20 years, and every 20 years there are complaints about the process, but this is one that actually made it through.
Yeah. Okay, let's get your calls on now. You can get through to us at 549-2937. In a moment, we'll talk about the legal process, whether this amendment may actually be put before you in November. But right now, let us know where you stand on the controversy over dog racing in Florida. We do have one track in our area, Best Bet Orange Park. There are 11 around the state. Florida is one of only, I think it's less than 10 states now that still does this. 549-2937. Mark in St. Augustine. Hi, Mark. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. I have a question, not so much about the dog racing part, but the whole process. You were just talking a little bit about the commission that decides what goes on the constitutional amendments. And it just seems to me that whenever these type of issues comes up, it's almost like we're giving a pass to our legislators that they don't have to consider, I guess, controversial issues. I remember years ago there was a constitutional amendment about the humane treatment of pigs. And it just seems to me that these kinds of things, in my opinion, don't rise to a constitutional amendment level. I think the legislators ought to be petitioned and have them pass a law if they want to outlaw it or keep it. You know, personally, I'm all for outlawing it. I don't have a dog in that fight, no pun intended. Hmm. But this whole issue about a constitutional amendment to address it, this seems like we're giving a pass to our folks in Tallahassee.
All right. Thanks, Mark.
Yeah, that's a common complaint, actually, you know, in terms of the CRC process, is that, you know, why are certain things elevated to a constitutional status? And this could be arguably one of them. Why isn't this handled by, you know, Tallahassee?
By the legislature. But as you pointed out,
yeah,
the reasons for that have to do with gambling interests in the state.
Right. There's aggressive lobbying on all sides. And I mean, we've seen it. We see it with the whiskey and Wheaties debate, which is basically, you know, where they want to add liquor to grocery stores. That's something that's been up a few times. There's always thought that we're going to get it through this time and then it doesn't happen. And it's something like when you have competing interests hitting these legislators trying to get both houses in line, it's very difficult.
And he pointed out, too, some of the strange amendments that occasionally make their way under the ballot, like the one dealing with pregnant pigs. I remember that one. People go that route when they feel they can't get relief through the legislature for whatever their interest is. And that's what we're seeing now.
Yeah. And, you know, we're going to continue to see it. It's just a quirk in Florida's system. I mean, if we have this discussion 20 years from now, we'll probably have the same discussion about different things. It's just, you know, right now the legislature does not respond well to competing interest on each side of its donations.
Okay, it's 549-2937. Where do you stand on banning greyhound racing in Florida? Samantha in St. Augustine. Hello, good morning.
Good morning. I have very strong feelings anti-racing. I've been owned by retired racing greyhounds since 1999. I adopted my first one up in Minnesota and got involved in some of the adoption processes. And we were getting dogs that were being illegally sold for lab research to guidance labs in the St. Paul suburbs. And it was just a nightmare getting those dogs out of there. I had dogs that I fostered that were being starved. I had dogs that were being abused, muzzled constantly. People think that the dogs are violent because of the muzzling. They're competitive. They're not violent. It was a nightmare. And it's wrong. It's wrong on a million different levels. And when you see that side of the industry, I mean, we don't allow our athletes to be drugged, yet these dogs are drugged in many cases.
Okay. So clearly you're against it. Yeah.
I love being able to adopt the dogs when they finish with them, but that's the only really good thing. And there are still thousands of dogs being put to death every year that are perfectly fine and healthy. And a lot of them are not looked after the way we look after our own pets when they're racing.
Thanks, Samantha. Thanks for that. And people, you know, it's amazing to me. People have incredibly strong feelings about animals.
Yeah.
Often more than they do about their fellow humans. And this is one example. And not to discount Samantha at all, she clearly loves these animals. And it's understood. I mean, they're beautiful, incredible animals.
Right. You know, and that's the moral case against dog racing. I mean, but, you know, you have to go back. I mean, we talked about the legal arguments. It's probably a good time to pivot to that. You know, looking at why the judge threw this off the ballot and whether that will actually prevail.
Yeah, so what was her reasoning? Why did she throw it off?
Well, we get to use trickeration again.
She called it trickeration.
You know, just the misleading ballot language, the summary and the title, you know, not saying that dog racing could still be bet on in Florida. You know, but this is the thing with Karen Gevers. I mean, she was the judge who just a few months ago overruled the state in terms of banning smokable medical marijuana. You know, that went through the appeals process and, you know, the appeals court said a different thing. And it's like, this is something that could happen here too. You've got two appeal stops. This will go to the Supreme Court. You know, Pam Bondi's already, you know, asked for an expedited appeal on one side. And, you know, so you're going to see this move very quickly because the state sees it as in its compelling interest.
And is the state likely to win the day here?
You know, based on what happens with Gevers cases. Yeah. I mean, Gevers came, you know, she was a Democratic politician in the 90s. She ran against Bill Nelson for assurance commissioner in primary, didn't win that one. Ran against Catherine Hipsher, Secretary of State, didn't win that one. However, she's very much a Democrat and, you know, this is very much a Republican state. So, you know, when I look at this, you know, issue, I think that the state will prevail because, you know, Pam Bondi tends to win arguments like this.
What's interesting, too, though, as you pointed out, is this is that rare issue that has a lot of bipartisan support.
Right. You know, and that's really the thing. It's like a lot of, you know, this is where Giever's case comes into play. It's like Giever's is saying that the amendment isn't doing what its bill is doing. It's not banning dog racing. And, you know, we're hearing it in our calls.
So she's getting into an arcane legal argument over the wording of the amendment, not saying she's for or against the issue.
Yeah, I mean, I don't see it as an arcane legal argument. I see it as, you know, if you're looking at the amendment, is it doing what it says it's going to do? And it's like, you can still bet on dog racing. You know, it is an expansion of gambling, you know, as conceived. You know, if you're an anti-gambling person, which was a big deal here a decade, two decades ago, still a big deal in certain parts of the state, you know, you're not looking to expand horse racing or hiyalaya or things like that. You know, you have an issue with gambling itself. So, I mean, this is an intersection of different issues, but really, you know, Giever's role is simple. It's like, does this meet the actual test what the amendment says it's going to do? She says it doesn't. You know, they've got two appeal stops ahead of them to, you know, convince judges otherwise.
And it's amazing how many amendments in the past haven't met that test and made its way through. I guess maybe she didn't appreciate seeing that. I don't know. But
well, you just got to have the better lawyers.
Yeah. All right. Let's take a few more calls. 549-2937. Dave in Nassau County. Hi, Dave.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. My question is that I worked at a dog track in West Memphis, Arkansas, back in the 80s. Now, I didn't work with the dogs. I worked on the tote machines. But I didn't see anything, from what I could tell, of the degree of abuse that people are describing. My question is, if things are really that bad for these dogs, why isn't there better oversight?
Yeah, I think that's a question a lot have asked, which is why this amendment has gained momentum, Dave. Let's talk about the oversight or lack of it at these tracks.
Yeah, I mean, the tracks will tell you that they are doing everything they can to take care of the dogs. The dogs are treated like family and so on. But, you know, when you see the contra evidence, it's not there. When you hear the dogs dying, you know, these dogs are in competitive shape and they're dying every few days. You know, that's an issue. When the dogs are starved to death, that's an issue.
When they're drugged with cocaine.
Right. You know, and, you know, it's that part of the business, the training of the dogs, is going to be isolated from other parts of the shop. I mean, it's not something where, you know, they're going to call everybody and say, hey, let's look at this dog being given cocaine, or let's look at this dog that's emaciated. You know, no, I mean, it's something where they look at it and, you know, you keep these things isolated. And that's what's happening with these animal trainers.
549-2937. Kathleen is on the line in Jacksonville. Hi, Kathleen. Good morning. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning. How are you?
Okay, thanks.
Good. I am calling. I'm against the Amendment 13. I think some instances, no matter what basket you have bad apples in every basket. But these dogs, they test the winner of every dog, and they test a random dog in every single race for drugs. These dogs get fed between 2 to 3 pounds of food especially for athletes every day. If there's an incident where something has happened to the dog and it's the kennel's fault, why not go after that kennel? Why go after everybody?
Go after everybody, you know, meaning what?
The whole greyhound industry. You say a dog mm-hmm. passed away or a dog is malnourished. Why not go after that kennel? Why are we going after everyone? I don't think these incidences are occurring as quickly and as fast or as often as everyone says. They're not having proof. And if they did have proof, why didn't they report it then? And why didn't the city take or the state take action at that time? Why are we trying to end the whole industry? It is a good industry, and it does provide a lot of employment for a lot of people.
Thanks for the call. How many people are employed in this industry? Do we, what, a couple thousand? I don't know the answer to that.
Yeah, I mean, you have to add up the dog tracks. You have to add up the people working the kennels. So,
yeah,
I'd say it runs into thousands. And the caller's arguments were along the lines of what the Greyhound lobby is saying, that, you know, by and large it's safe, by and large, you know, things are fine. But there's been this isn't new. We've been talking about drugs and dogs for 5 years, 10 years. It's a recurring dialogue. And,
And don't the gambling interests in the state, the betting parlors, don't they want to uncouple their industry from this? That's what I've been given to understand. They don't want this association. But as of right now, under Florida law, they're coupled together, correct?
Exactly. That's the paradox, is even if they want to get out of the dog racing business, they can't maintain their gambling licenses, which really are the future. If you look at something like Best Bet is much more promoting its poker at this point than it is promoting its dog races.
They'd like to unload the dog races.
Right. But I wanted to come back to another point the caller made about the drugs, cocaine. Cocaine metabolizes very quickly compared to other drugs. So it's like, a human being, for example, metabolizes in a few days. With a dog that's got no body fat, that's active, that's just bred to run, is only running, that shelf life can be a lot quicker. So, that's where cocaine becomes a useful drug for these amateurs trying to get short-term performance improvement.
Lots of tweets on this issue. Dan tweets the show, "For me, it's more about the treatment of the animals than the gambling. They don't treat the dogs well, and it gets worse for the dogs that don't win." On Facebook, lots of comments. They need to get a more worthwhile profession, says Dave's. You can't use that worn out argument every time that this is an honest profession. Rhoda writes, "I've seen greyhounds who were lucky enough to get adopted after retirement and their bodies were worn. What about the ramifications, though? Where will they go if this sport is shut down? The dogs hopefully would be adopted out. As the other caller pointed out, the people that work in the industry probably would be out of a job or would have to reconfigure how they work with animals. Here's a comment from Nick. It's dumb, pure, and simple. The dogs are treated horribly, then cast aside when they get older. It should be banned." So, okay. This is one of those amendments that I think would get 60% support if it made its way onto the ballot.
Yeah, I mean, you see different coalitions of support that don't always line up on everything else, lining up on this one. Yeah, it's just the question is the judge right in terms of the language not matching the intent of the amendment?
But as you said, this is going to be fast-tracked. We'll have an answer pretty soon.
Yeah, I would say so, because ballots for November got to be printed up pretty soon after primary. So, there's compelling interest to get it done.
And before we let you go, you're known for your nonstop coverage of Florida politicians leading up to the Florida primary, which is August 28th, just a few weeks away. Let's talk for just a few minutes about the big action in Jacksonville this week as the gubernatorial candidates come to town.
Right. You've got a Democratic forum on Thursday, but the really interesting action, I believe, is going to be Wednesday, the Republican gubernatorial debate. Adam Putnam, the establishment choice, versus Ron DeSantis, the congressman endorsed by President Trump. The Trump endorsement has looked to be this positive so far. Once Trump come in behind DeSantis, DeSantis went up in the polls, and right now it looks like a double-digit race. Putnam wants to close that gap, and to that end, he wants to play up Florida issues, which is something that he thinks DeSantis doesn't really address. A lot of people agree with him. So expect this debate to be more on Florida issues than the other one these two had, which was on Fox News and had a lot of national issues, and it wasn't playing to Putnam's strengths. This is Putnam's do-or-die moment. On Thursday...
And that's Wednesday night on the JU campus.
Right.
And it will broadcast on our news partner, Channel 4.
Right.
Yeah.
And then 24 hours later, the Democrats going to have a forum also.
Also televised?
Yes, also televised, also on 4, also 8 o'clock at JU. Gwen Graham looks to be the front runner right now. The public polls are saying so. Her internal polls are confirming that. She's getting some distance between the other candidates. Her narrative has been Gwen and the men. The men are all kind of bundled up, and women tend to be coalescing behind Graham right now. She's sort of a moderate Democrat in a Hillary Clinton vein. So if you see, a Graham DeSantis race, you might see 2016's Clinton-Trump race all over again in terms of, Florida state politics, which, could be interesting, but we know how it went for Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton.
Right. So, 2 years on, though, will Trump's mounting scandals affect turnout in this swing state?
See, that's the open question.
That's the question.
And the other question is, does Graham energize the progressives? Because right. that's what Clinton couldn't do last campaign. You know, the black vote didn't turn out, progressives didn't turn out, and that's how you got that 100,000 vote margin for Donald Trump in the end, because he turned out his voters out in the sticks.
Yeah, who can turn their voters out? And would say a nominee, would a Graham nominee maybe tap someone on the progressive side, like Andrew Gillum, to be her running mate to try to close that issue?
I don't know if Gillum's the choice, because they've thrown such sharp elbows at each other. But if you look at somebody else who's running, Chris King, Chris King's an Orlando businessman. He's in his mid-30s. I mean, he has hit Graham on sugar ties and, you know, such, but it's nothing that can't be papered over. It's a little bit more personal with Graham and Gillum, though.
And then on the Republican side, as we see DeSantis pulling ahead to this double-digit lead, it's been really remarkable to watch on the Republican side how this candidate for governor has campaigned in a completely different way than candidates traditionally do when they're running for statewide office here. The way Adam Putnam has been campaigning, the old-fashioned way, going to event after event, making the case around Florida issues, selling his Florida roots. DeSantis is campaigning largely through appearances on Fox News and in a few other forums, not going the traditional route. And so far, it seems to be working for him.
Right. And that's the thing that people, including myself, had questions about when DeSantis got in the race. It's like, yeah, you've got the Trump backing, but, you know, you're not hitting every county. You're not hitting every little event. I mean, Adam Putnam's got an event here in town today with local Republicans, for example. I mean, Putnam has put in the work than the retail politics.
Lots of shoe leather, yeah.
Yeah, but, you know, when the state is changing, you've got a lot of people who moved here from elsewhere. Got a lot of people who are voting based on what they see on TV, not based on a handshake and a barbecue plate. And, you know, this is something that Putnam, he may not be able to close the deal. He may have to go away for 4 or 8 years, do something else. Because it looks like DeSantis is race to lose. And DeSantis has not gotten much wrong in his campaign. You know, most of the media bet against him. And he has proven them wrong. And, you know, he's been outraised by Putnam. It doesn't matter. Because Donald Trump Jr. and all these Fox News all-stars come in, campaign for him, and that gives him juice that Putnam doesn't have. We saw 8 years ago also Rick Scott and Bill McCollum, and, you know, Bill McCollum was, you know, he did everything by the rules.
He was the establishment candidate. It did not work for him either.
No, Rick Scott, he was able to, you know, spend money on TV. He got there. That's what happened for him. But, you know, there was no Donald Trump effect in 2010. So that's kind of the difference. I mean, Donald Trump is worth a ton of earned media.
Okay. So again, to recap, Wednesday night, the Republican debate will be televised here in town on WJXT Channel 4, our news partner, live from the JU campus. And then the following night, the Democrats come into JU for a live televised forum. And we'll have excerpts of that here at 89.9 through the week as well. A.G. Gankarski of Florida Politics, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And much more still ahead later. The preseason gets underway this week. Culpepper has a look at how the Jaguars are shaping up for their first preseason matchup. It's on Thursday. But up next, First Coast author Nikesha Williams. We'll be right back.
WJCT's Jaguars season parking is still available. Be part of the coolest tailgating downtown. Includes paved space and indoor bathroom access. Contact Holly Manuel at 358-6311 or log on to wjct.org/parking. Reserve your space today.
asked me out, and I have to say yes, because guess why? Ends up he had been driving around the block for a month waiting for me to come out, and nothing says love like stalking.
Join us next time for the Moth Radio Hour, True Stories Told Live, from the Public Radio Exchange, PRX.org.
Saturday at noon on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. It's a new novel from local author and TV news producer Nikisha Williams. Is her protagonist Ebony Jones a cold-blooded killer or a survivor of domestic abuse? The novel The Appeal of Ebony Jones is out now, and Nikisha Williams joins us with a look inside. Good morning.
Good morning.
And congratulations, another book by you.
I know, thank you.
This is your second book, your first one, Four Women, your debut. And in this new one, your main character, Ebony Jones, is standing trial on murder charges.
Yes.
A crime she says she did not commit. How did you come up with this character?
So The Appeal of Ebony Jones is really the continuation of the story from Four Women. Four Women ended on a cliffhanger that I was told I could not leave like that by so many friends and people who have read the book, that they were like, you've got to write a sequel. And I was like, well, I'm not sure how to do that, how to take that story and push it forward. And so now I kind of figured out a way to do it and continue the story and kind of just get back into the lives of the four women that we met in the very first novel.
And your first book, like this one, was set in Jacksonville.
Yes.
So it's fiction, but with some local color, some local elements. Tell me a little bit about the style and the setting of the book.
It's just kind of like how New York City was the fifth character in Sex and the City. And Four Women and in The Appeal of Ebony Jones, Jacksonville is in and of itself is a character. So if you live here, if you work here, if you're from the city, or even if you visited here, you'll recognize landmarks. And it just kind of sets the backdrop of what's going on, what's happening, and kind of plays as that underlying current that keeps the book consistent.
Did you draw inspiration from any real life cases? For example, Ebony's argument is that she was a victim of domestic violence. That brings to mind for me Marissa Alexander, the Jacksonville woman who was sentenced to 20 years initially. Mm-hmm. She fired a shot at her husband, who she said was abusive and threatening her. He wasn't even injured.
Right.
And yet it became very controversial when she got a 20-year sentence. She tried to use the state's stand your ground law as self-defense. That didn't work. But eventually she won her release. Was that an inspiration for you?
It definitely was. So, and just with the first book, all the things that were happening, because the book is set in Jacksonville in 2014. And so The Appeal of Ebony Jones kind of starts in like September of that year and goes all the way through until like April of 2015. And so there are definitely real life events happening in Jacksonville that have inspired the book, but also in the world over. A couple of the backdrops that are real news items were the killings of Michelle Cousseau. It ends in the time of Freddie Gray, but Marissa was definitely inspiration for some of the character plots and twist points in the novel for Ebony, yes.
And so through the story of Ebony, you're really commenting on our criminal justice system.
I am.
Particularly how it treats people and women of color.
Yes.
Let's talk a little bit about that.
I feel like, especially in the time that we live in today, that so many things happen and yet we don't always characterize the victims as the same. Whereas if it were a woman of color or a man of color and they're arrested or have an encounter with police or unfortunately killed, we're quick to look at, well, what is their criminal record? What have they done wrong? What is their history? Let's dig up all this dirt that we can. But it's like, they're still a victim. And we don't always put that characterization of people of another race. And so with Ebony's character, I kind of want to go into her psyche and into who she is as a woman and as a person, not just as a suspect. Is she a victim? Is there something that has happened in her life that put her into these circumstances, into these crosshairs with the criminal justice system? And then what justice is there for her?
How much research went into this book?
A lot. as a news producer, I'm familiar with the Stand Your Ground statute, which is an addendum to the Castle Law Doctrine. But I sat with an attorney for a couple of hours and just kind of picked his brain about what can I do in terms of the fiction, in terms of the law, and what can be able to be, what is able to be done for a suspect or a client or a victim in a similar situation with an attorney. And so he really allowed me to frame the story around an argument that he would have. It's Dale Carson Law that's here in Jacksonville. He let me go and just find out everything I could about the law. And then just kind of getting into the research of the news at the time and what was available, and then more so anything and ever, digging deeper into the characters to find out more about them.
Yeah. And you, now let's point out too, you're publishing this second novel while continuing to work in a local television newsroom.
I am.
You produce the 11 p.m. news at Action News Jax, the CBS Fox affiliate in Jacksonville. So tell me about your routine, how you were able to write and work and get it all done.
So doing the 11 p.m. show has actually given me more time to write, because my son, who is 3, has to be at school by 9 in the morning. So I'm usually up by 8. Usually I'm up by 7:30. I wake him up by 8, get him dressed and fed, and he's at school by 9. And then I'm back home at 9:30. And from 9:30 to 1:30, I'm writing. And then I try to stop down about 1:30. Sometimes if the writing is good, then I push it a little longer. Mm-hmm. But then I go to work from 2:30 to about midnight, and then I come home. And if there's something pressing, then I may stay up until like 2 in the morning and write some more. Or if not, then I'll go back and get in the bed and then
do
it all over.
What do you mean something pressing? You've got a new idea?
Not so much a new idea. Like if I'm in a chapter and I didn't finish it and I was really close, then I'll get home and I'll just try to finish it out and bang it out if I can still see straight. Or if I have to like edit some video to do like a promotional something to put on social media, I'll do that. Otherwise, I'll try to get in the bed and then I do it all again the next morning at 7:30.
How did you go about publishing once you got your books, your first book done? And I think you talked about this a little bit when you were here before. For a first time author, a new author, that every author I've ever interviewed, that can be the even harder than getting the book written.
It is. Publishing is a very difficult beast to grab a hold of and to handle. With my first novel, I was finished a novel, tried to find an agent, couldn't find an agent, was going to self-publish, found an agent a week before I was going to self-publish, took everything down, worked with an agent, did 2 major revisions. They pitched it to as many people that they could. Nothing happened. That was all of 2016. I think the end of 2016, that's when the Jacksonville Public Library announced their very first at the inaugural book festival. And I was like, hey, I can go to that. And my agents were like, sure. But by the time I was going to apply to go, the deadline had already passed, where they were like, we'll still go. We'll print up some galleys and some samplers, and we'll take those and you can just network. So I did that. And during that time, I think I actually made a trailer for the first book, and they sent that out to publishers and they were like,
hey, a trailer, a video.
Yeah, a video trailer of like promoting the novel. And so as soon as I did that, we got more entreaties from publishers like, yeah, we want to go for it. And then it was like nothing happened. So by mid-2017, my agents were like, no, we'll drop you. We can't sell it. So then I self-published it under my own company, which I established here in Florida, called New Reads Publications. So this time around, I didn't even try to look for a major publisher. I just went on my own.
And self-publishing, that's increasingly what authors are doing. It can be tough to get a publishing house to publish books, but self-published books, there are so many good ones out there, of which yours is one. And so, again, the website is newrights.com. And as you come out with The Appeal of Ebony Jones, what's been the reaction so far?
So far, it's been good. It's been out 3 days. So It just dropped on Friday. But so far, the reaction has been pretty good. And we'll see. The official release will be here in Jacksonville at Yellow House on August 18th at 6 p.m.
I'm sorry, say that again.
Saturday, August 18th at 6 p.m. at Yellow House will be the official Jacksonville release party.
Okay. So it's a chance for people to come out and meet you.
Yeah.
Now, let me ask you, are you going to keep writing? Do you see writing as your career now? Or is it, you know, what's your ultimate goal with your writing, Nikesha?
the ultimate goal is to make that the full-time career. But because I'm a media person, and even the way I write, many people have said they can see it. And when I'm writing, I write what I see. I write in present tense. So it's like you're dropped right into the middle of the book, and then you see everything that I want you to see. So, I mean, the ultimate goal, I guess, would, of course, be to get it to film or to television. But right now, I will keep writing. I'm working on a couple more projects to come out next year. So it's a lot ahead.
A lot ahead.
Yeah.
And you continue to work at Action News.
Yes.
Something else that made headlines recently, the Cox Company owns your station. They are putting the television properties around the country up for sale. How are you with all of that and your fellow employees?
Me personally, I heard the news and I was like, oh, that just means you need to write faster. Like, that was my first thought. I need to write faster, need to work harder to get to where I need to be before everything that kind of has been set in place as my security blanket may be taken away from me. But at this point, nobody knows what's really going to happen. We won't know until there is a buyer or a merger or whatever the case may be. I'm not that high up to give any real answers. So when the world finds out, it's probably when we'll find out.
Yeah. Do you think you might eventually go back to Chicago? You're a Chicago native, right?
I'm a Chicago girl.
But went to Florida State.
Yes, I'm a Chicago Southside girl through and through. I would love to go home. My mom is there. My brother is there. My nephew is there. But, you know, right now my husband and my family is here in Jacksonville. So, you know, Jacksonville's been good to me.
What does your husband think about your success as a writer?
He likes it. He doesn't really pay me much attention, but he likes it.
He doesn't. That's not good.
He's like, oh, you got some talent there, but he's fine.
All right. So if you're just tuning in, we're talking with First Coast author and television news producer Nikisha Williams. It's her second novel. Her first, Four Women, came out a couple of years ago. The new one, The Appeal of Ebony Jones, was released just last week. And can you tell us again where people can come out and see you and get a copy?
So you can come out on August 18th at 6 p.m. at Yellow House in Riverside. And that will be the official release event. You can get a copy on Amazon, iBooks, and Kindle. I have to stop by Chamblin's Uptown and bring them their copies, and we'll try to get them in San Marco Books and More as well. But for right now, Amazon, iBooks, and Kindle is your best bet. Or if you follow me on social media at Nikisha Elise everywhere, just inbox me and I can get you a signed copy and we can work that out.
All right, Nikisha Williams, congratulations. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
A quick break, and in a moment, the Jaguars are finally set for their preseason opener. It's coming up this Thursday against the Saints. Did you get your tickets? Culpepper has a look at the team's chances for this season and the rest of the weekend sports news and notes. We will be right back.
Hospice and palliative care. Since 1979, the compassionate guide for more than 200,000 patients facing advanced illness in Northeast Florida. Today, serving 16 counties, including yours, available 24/7 to help you and your loved one. More at choosecommunityhospice.com.
ViStar Credit Union is a financial cooperative focused on delivering quality financial services for its members. ViStar, we never forget that it's your money. Information available at 777-6000 or on the web at vistarcu.org.
A federal court in Orlando has ruled that a colonial-era shipwreck found off of Cape Canaveral belongs to France. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, will discuss the sunken ships of Jean Ribault. We'll talk about the Greetings from Florida exhibition at the Brevard Museum of History and Natural Science and architect Elton Moten. That's Florida Frontiers, Monday evening at 6:30 on 89.9 WJCT.
It's been almost 1 year since Charlottesville, Virginia, erupted in hate. A new investigation into the origins of the deadly white nationalist rally and the response by law enforcement. I'm Tanzina Vega, and that's next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International.
Weekdays at 2 on 89.9 WJCT.
Our beaches are disappearing. Two-thirds of Southern California's sandy shore could be gone this century. But that's not all. You know what else depends on sand? Roads, buildings, computer screens, and phones. And it's running out. What do we bury our heads in then? Who's robbing the sandbanks? Next time on 1A.
Today at 11 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Finally this hour, the Jaguars are looking forward to their preseason opener this week. It's Thursday night against the Saints.
I'm a pepper, he's a pepper, she's a pepper, we're a pepper. Wouldn't you like to be a pepper too?
And Culpepper says Doug Marrone is less than satisfied with how practice has been going. He's here now with a closer look at sports. Hey, Cole.
Hello. Melissa, I don't want to say he's been unsatisfied in general with the way practice has been going, but what he has noted is that the team did not practice as well the day after a day off.
Oh.
So after the Friday night family night inside the stadium, a day off Saturday, yesterday he really put him through the ringer in what was the hottest and most uncomfortable day of training camp so far this year. Really let them know it. The practice was long, it was hot, it was grueling. Marrone wants to see consistency from the team, and he's pushing them harder than ever so that game day, when it rolls around, will feel like a walk in the park by comparison.
You know, I do think sometimes you go in as, you know, there's a little bit of improvement, and then you may have a practice where you take a little bit of a dip, then improvement, dip, improvement, you know. But what you don't want to see is a great practice, a very poor practice. You don't want to see that type of inconsistency. So at the end of the day, when you look at all the practices backed up, and if you put it on a graph, you would see the incline going up gradually with the dots that, you know, they may move a little bit up or down, but they're never going to be like this. So that's one of the things that we try to, you know, keep in our mind as we go to keep pushing them.
You know, the Jaguars are going to face the Saints, as you mentioned, on Thursday. It is the preseason opener. I'm not going to get too worked up by the result, but I do expect that the atmosphere will be a good one early on, as it was Friday night when the Jaguars had the practice inside the stadium. But I'll say this, the Jaguars have looked good. In fact, they have looked better at this point in training camp than I have seen in a decade or more. So that is
not nothing.
It's not nothing. It doesn't mean that they're necessarily going to be great, but it's a good start. A lot of talk about, you know, how will Blake Bortles be? Another note for you that yesterday during the practice, the Jaguars were doing this basically a drill where they put the first team offense against the first team defense in a situation where they were down by 10 points with 2.5 minutes remaining. And in the scenario, Bortles led the offense to a touchdown against the first team defense and then a field goal, which would have tied it and sent the game to overtime. So, again, some good signs for the offense coming along. We know about the defense, but the offense is really starting to show some signs as training camp continues.
All right. My husband's going. Lots of people excited to be there. It's going to be a great night at TIAA Bank Field, which we still have to get used to saying.
I may just start going with the bank.
The bank. Okay. All right. Let's talk about Brian Dawkins, inducted over the weekend into the Pro Football Hall of Fame.
Yeah, the former Raines High School star enshrined in Canton. What a night. He wanted to share his gold jacket with so many who influenced his road to football immortality. He also talked about his battle with depression, saying that he actually had planned a suicide attempt at one point. His speech was powerful, telling the world that if you're going through tough times, you need to keep going. Don't stop. It was very moving, very powerful. And if you haven't had a chance to see that, you can find it online. But it's
watch that. Did people know he'd been struggling with it?
He has talked about it since his career ended. I'm not sure that he ever talked about it publicly during his career. That was a bit of a taboo subject in a lot of locker rooms, and in some regards still is. You know, when this is a game for big, tough men, and it's sometimes looked at as a sign of weakness in a locker room. Obviously, we know how important mental health issues are for everybody. And to have a Hall of Famer who is, you know, at the pinnacle of his sport talking about it, I think has a chance to do some real good.
And what pride for Reigns.
Yeah. And he mentioned Reigns. He mentioned his Pop Warner team. He mentioned, you know, basically went through a litany. Hey, see, you all have a piece of this jacket. You all are now Hall of Famers. Of course, to see what he has accomplished and joining Bob Hayes now from Jacksonville in the Hall of Fame, a pretty special moment. Maybe next year, Tony Boselli gets his chance
to go to the Hall of Fame. Wouldn't that be nice, too? Oh, I hope so. Okay, so let's talk about Florida, Georgia, too, before we let you go. They both started their fall practice over the last week or so.
And Florida State opens today. So I just want to just quickly touch on what I see as the biggest question for each school heading into the season. For Florida, big question has got to be who the quarterback's going to be. Felipe Franks or Kyle Trask? Maybe Emory Jones also one they could look at. The old saying is if you have two quarterbacks, you don't have a quarterback. So right now, Florida's got to figure out if they have two quarterbacks or if they actually have a quarterback somewhere in there who they can really rely on. For Georgia, big question is they can rebound from last year's devastating loss in the national championship game. They lost some talent, sure, but they've recruited very well. The Bulldogs came within an eyelash of winning their first title since 1980. You have to wonder if there's going to be any hangover or if that will motivate the Bulldogs here in 2018. And for Florida State, can Willie Taggart get the Noles offense looking like his teams did at USF when he ran what he called the Gulf Coast offense? He wants to play fast, and a lot of that comes down to the quarterback, of course. DeAndre Francois and James Blackman are the two candidates. Francois looked like a potential future Heisman Trophy candidate before a knee injury in the season opener last year against Alabama ended his year. Blackman played as a freshman. He has a ways to go, though. We'll see how it all rolls out. A lot of new in the area when you talk about two new coaches at Florida and Florida State. And Georgia now looks like they have newly reestablished themselves as a national power.
New blood. And again, that's a preseason opener Thursday night at the Bank, as Cole calls it, against the New Orleans Saints. Probably going to sell out or close to it.
Yeah, right? I think it's going to be well attended. Typically, these preseason games, you get some folks who tend to linger out after a while. But because it's a 7 o'clock start on a Thursday night, I'll be interested to see how the tailgating looks as we roll into the stadium.
Let me just make that plug for you can rent a tailgating spot for Jaguars games right here at WJCT. Right across the street. We've had people tailgating in our lot for years and years. So if you're interested, just call us up. And always listen to Cole every Monday morning on this program. Catch him at night on Channel 4, our the local station, our news partner. As always, thanks for being here, my friend.
Thanks, Melissa.
And that's our show. Thanks for listening. 1A is up next. I'm Melissa Ross. This is 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville. We'll be back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.